Section 3 of Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose as long as Legamus is credited. Chapter 1, Part 3. To continue the story. Skating farther than their wont that day, they reached that part of the river where the ships had anchored and been frozen in midstream. Among them was the ship of the Muscovite Embassy, flying its double-headed black eagle from the main mast, which was hung with many-coloured icicles several yards in length. Sasha had left some of her clothing on board, and supposing the ship to be empty, they climbed on deck and went in search of it. Remembering certain passages in his own past, Orlando would not have marvelled had some good citizens sought this refuge before them, and so it turned out. They had not ventured far when a fine young man started up from some business of his own behind a coil of rope, and saying, apparently, for he spoke Russian, that he was one of the crew, and would help the princess to find what she wanted, lit a lump of candle, and disappeared with her into the lower parts of the ship. Time went by, and Orlando, wrapped in his own dreams, thought only of the pleasures of life, of his jewel, of her rarity, of means for making her irrevocably and indissolubly his own. Obstacles there were, and hardships to overcome. She was determined to live in Russia, where there were frozen rivers and wild horses, and men, she said, who gashed each other's throats open. It is true that a landscape of pine and snow, habits of lust and slaughter, did not entice him. Nor was he anxious to cease his pleasant country ways of sport and tree-planting, relinquish his office, ruin his career, shoot the reindeer instead of the rabbit, drink vodka instead of canary, and slip a knife up his sleeve, for what purpose he knew not. Still, all this, and more than all this, he would do for her sake. As for his marriage to the Lady Margaret, fixed though it was for this day se'nnight, the thing was so palpably absurd that he scarcely gave it a thought. Her kinsmen would abuse him for deserting a great lady. His friends would deride him for ruining the finest career in the world, for a Cossack woman and a waste of snow. It weighed not a straw in the balance compared with Sasha herself. On the first dark night they would fly. They would take ship to Russia. So he pondered. So he plotted as he walked up and down the deck. He was recalled, turning westward, by the sight of the sun, slung like an orange on the cross of St. Paul's. It was blood-red and sinking rapidly. It must be almost evening. Sasha had been gone this hour and more. Seized instantly with those dark forebodings which shadowed even his most confident thoughts of her, he plunged the way he had seen them go into the hold of the ship, and, after stumbling among chests and barrels in the darkness, was made aware by a faint glimmer in a corner that they were seated there. For 1 second he had a vision of them, saw Sasha seated on the sailor's knee, saw her bend towards him, saw them embrace before the light was blotted out in a red cloud by his rage. He blazed into such a howl of anguish that the whole ship echoed. Sasha threw herself between them, or the sailor would have been stifled before he could draw his cutlass. Then a deadly sickness came over Orlando, and they had to lay him on the floor and give him brandy to drink before he revived. And then, when he had recovered, and was sat upon a heap of sacking on deck, Sasha hung over him, passing before his dizzied eyes softly, sinuously, like the fox that had bit him, now cajoling, now denouncing, so that he came to doubt what he had seen. Had not the candle guttered? Had not the shadows moved? The box was heavy, she said. The man was helping her to move it. Orlando believed her one moment, for who can be sure that his rage has not painted what he most dreads to find? The next was the more violent with anger at her deceit. Then Sasha herself turned white, stamped her foot on deck, said she would go that night and called upon her gods to destroy her if she, a Romanovitch, had lain in the arms of a common seaman. Indeed, looking at them together, which he could hardly bring himself to do, Orlando was outraged by the foulness of his imagination that could have painted so frail a creature in the paw of that hairy sea-brute. The man was huge, stood 6'4" in his stockings, wore common wire rings in his ears, and looked like a dray horse on which some wren or robin has perched in its flight. So he yielded, believed her, and asked her pardon. Yet, when they were going down the ship's side, lovingly again, Sasha paused with her hand on the ladder, and called back to this tawny, wide-cheeked monster a volley of Russian greetings, jests or endearments, not a word of which Orlando could understand. But there was something in her tone—it might be the fault of the Russian consonants—that reminded Orlando of a scene some nights since, when he had come upon her in secret gnawing a candle-end in a corner, which she had picked from the floor. True, it was pink, it was gilt, and it was from the king's table, but it was tallow, and she gnawed it. Was there not, he thought, handing her on to the ice, something rank in her, something coarse-flavoured, something peasant-born? And he fancied her at 40 grown unwieldy, though she was now slim as a reed, and lethargic, though she was now blithe as a lark. But again, as they skated towards London, such suspicions melted in his breast, and he felt as if he had been hooked by a great fish through the nose, and rushed through the waters unwillingly, yet with his own consent. It was an evening of astonishing beauty. As the sun sank, all the domes, spires, turrets, and pinnacles of London rose in inky blackness against the furious red sunset clouds. Here was the fretted cross at Charing, there the dome of St. Paul's, there the massy square of the Tower buildings, there, like a grove of trees stripped of all leaves, save a knob at the end, were the heads on the pikes at Temple Bar. Now the abbey windows were lit up, and burnt like a heavenly, many-coloured shield, in Orlando's fancy. Now all the west seemed a golden window with troops of angels, in Orlando's fancy again, passing up and down the heavenly stairs perpetually. All the time they seemed to be skating in fathomless depths of air, so blue the ice had become, and so glassy smooth was it that they sped quicker and quicker to the city, with the white gulls circling about them, and cutting in the air with their wings the very same sweeps that they cut on the ice with their skates. Sasha, as if to reassure him, was tenderer than usual, and even more delightful. Seldom would she talk about her past life, but now she told him how, in winter in Russia, she would listen to the wolves howling across the steppes, and thrice, to show him, she barked like a wolf. Upon which he told her of the stags in the snow at home, and how they would stray into the great hall for warmth, and be fed by an old man with porridge from a bucket. And then she praised him, for his love of beasts, for his gallantry, for his legs. Ravished with her praises, and shamed to think how he had maligned her by fancying her on the knees of a common sailor, and grown fat and lethargic at 40, he told her that he could find no words to praise her. Yet instantly bethought him how she was like the spring, and green grass and rushing waters, and seizing her more tightly than ever, he swung her with him half across the river, so that the gulls and the cormorants swung too. And halting at length, out of breath, she said, panting slightly, that he was like a million-candled Christmas tree, such as they have in Russia, hung with yellow globes, incandescent, enough to light a whole street by, so one might translate it, for what with his glowing cheeks, his dark curls, his black and crimson cloak, he looked as if he were burning with his own radiance from a lamp lit within. All the colour, save the red of Orlando's cheeks, soon faded. Night came on. As the orange light of sunset vanished, it was succeeded by an astonishing white glare from the torches, bonfires, flaming cressets, and other devices, by which the river was lit up, and the strangest transformation took place. Various churches and noblemen's palaces, whose fronts were of white stone, showed in streaks and patches as if floating on the air. Of St. Paul's, in particular, nothing was left but a gilt cross. The abbey appeared like the grey skeleton of a leaf. everything suffered emaciation and transformation. As they approached the carnival, they heard a deep note like that struck on a tuning fork, which boomed louder and louder until it became an uproar. Every now and then a great shout followed a rocket into the air. Gradually they could discern little figures breaking off from the vast crowd and spinning hither and thither like gnats on the surface of a river. Above and around this brilliant circle, like a bowl of darkness, pressed the deep black of a winter's night. And then, into this darkness, there began to rise, with pauses, which kept the expectation alert and the mouth open, flowering rockets, crescents, serpents, a crown. At one moment the woods and distant hills showed green as on a summer's day, the next all was winter and blackness again. By this time Orlando and the princess were close to the royal enclosure, and found their way barred by a great crowd of the common people, who were pressing as near to the silken rope as they dared. Loath to end their privacy, and encounter the sharp eyes that were on the watch for them, the couple lingered there, shouldered by apprentices, tailors, fishwives, horse-dealers, coney-catchers, starving scholars, maid-servants in their wimples, orange-girls, ostlers, sober citizens, bawdy tapsters, and a crowd of little ragamuffins, such as always haunt the outskirts of a crowd, screaming and scrambling among people's feet. All the riff-raff of the London streets, indeed, was there, jesting and jostling, here casting dice, telling fortunes, shoving, tickling, pinching, here uproarious, there glum, some of them with mouths gaping a yard wide, others as little reverent as doors on a housetop, all as variously rigged out as their purse or stations allowed, here in fur and broadcloth, there in tatters, with their feet kept from the ice only by a dishclout bound about them. The main press of people, it appeared, stood opposite a booth or stage something like our Punch and Judy show, upon which some kind of theatrical performance was going forward. A black man was waving his arms and vociferating. There was a woman in white laid upon a bed. Rough though the staging was, the actors running up and down a pair of steps and sometimes tripping, and the crowd stamping their feet and whistling, or, when they were bored, tossing a piece of orange peel onto the ice which a dog would scramble for. Still, the astonishing, sinuous melody of the words stirred Orlando like music. Spoken with extreme speed, and a daring agility of tongue, which reminded him of the sailors singing in the beer gardens at Wapping, the words, even without meaning, were as wine to him. But now and again a single phrase would come to him over the ice, which was as if torn from the depths of his heart. The frenzy of the moor seemed to him his own frenzy, and when the moor suffocated the woman in her bed, it was Sasha he killed with his own hands. At last the play was ended. All had grown dark. The tears streamed down his face. Looking up into the sky, there was nothing but blackness there too. Ruin and death, he thought, cover all. The life of man ends in the grave. Worms devour us. Methinks it should be now a huge eclipse of sun and moon, and that the affrighted globe should yawn. Even as he said this, a star of some pallor rose in his memory. The night was dark. It was pitch black. But it was such a night as this that they had waited for. It was on such a night as this that they had planned to fly. He remembered everything. The time had come. With a burst of passion he snatched Sasha to him and hissed in her ear, "Jour de ma vie!" It was their signal. At midnight they would meet at an inn near Blackfriars. Horses waited there. Everything was in readiness for their flight. So they parted, she to her tent, he to his. It still wanted an hour of the time. Long before midnight Orlando was in waiting. The night was of so inky a blackness that a man was on you before he could be seen, which was all to the good. But it was also of the most solemn stillness, so that a horse's hoof, or a child's cry, could be heard at a distance of half a mile. Many a time did Orlando, pacing the little courtyard, hold his heart at the sound of some nag's steady footfall on the cobbles, or at the rustle of a woman's dress. But the traveller was only some merchant, making home belated, or some woman of the quarter whose errand was nothing so innocent. They passed, and the street was quieter than before. Then those lights which burnt downstairs, in the small huddled quarters, where the poor of the city lived, moved up to the sleeping rooms, and then, one by one, were extinguished. The street lanterns in these purlieus were few at most, and the negligence of the night watchman often suffered them to expire long before dawn. The darkness then became even deeper than before. Orlando looked to the wicks of his lantern, saw to the saddle girths, primed his pistols, examined his holsters, and did all these things a dozen times at least, till he could find nothing more needing his attention. Though it still lacked some 20 minutes to midnight, he could not bring himself to go indoors to the inn parlour, where the hostess was still serving sack, and the cheaper sort of canary wine, to a few seafaring men, who would sit there trolling their ditties, and telling their stories of Drake, Hawkins, and Grenville, till they toppled off the benches and rolled asleep on the sanded floor. The darkness was more compassionate to his swollen and violent heart. He listened to every footfall, speculated on every sound. Each drunken shout, and each wail from some poor wretch laid in the straw or in other distress, cut his heart to the quick, as if it boded ill omen to his venture. Yet he had no fear for Sasha. Her courage made nothing of the adventure. She would come alone, in her cloak and trousers, booted like a man. Light as her footfall was, it would hardly be heard, even in this silence. So he waited in the darkness. Suddenly he was struck in the face by a blow, soft yet heavy, on the side of his cheek. So strung with expectation was he that he started and put his hand to his sword. The blow was repeated a dozen times on forehead and cheek. The dry frost had lasted so long that it took him a moment to realize that these were raindrops falling. The blows were the blows of the rain. At first they fell slowly, deliberately, one by one. But soon the 6 drops became 60, then 600, then ran themselves together in a steady spout of water. It was as if the hard and consolidated sky poured itself forth in one profuse fountain. In the space of 5 minutes Orlando was soaked to the skin. Hastily putting the horses under cover, he sought shelter beneath the lintel of the door, whence he could still observe the courtyard. The air was thicker now than ever, and such a steaming and droning rose from the downpour that no footfall of man or beast could be heard above it. The roads, pitted as they were with great holes, would be under water, and perhaps impassable. But of what effect this would have upon their flight, he scarcely thought. All his senses were bent upon gazing along the cobbled pathway, gleaming in the light of the lantern, for Sasha's coming. Sometimes, in the darkness, he seemed to see her wrapped about with rainstrokes, but the phantom vanished. Suddenly, with an awful and ominous voice, a voice full of horror and alarm, which raised every hair of anguish in Orlando's soul, St. Peter's struck the first stroke of midnight. 4 times more it struck remorselessly. With the superstition of a lover, Orlando had made out that it was on the 6th stroke that she would come. But the 6th stroke echoed away, and the 7th came, and the 8th, and to his apprehensive mind they seemed notes first heralding, and then proclaiming death and disaster. When the 12th struck, he knew that his doom was sealed. It was useless for the rational part of him to reason. She might be late, she might be prevented, she might have missed her way. The passionate and feeling heart of Orlando knew the truth. Other clocks struck, jangling one after another. The whole world seemed to ring with the news of her deceit and his derision. The old suspicions, subterraneously at work in him, rushed forth from concealment openly. He was bitten by a swarm of snakes, each more poisonous than the last. He stood in the doorway, in the tremendous rain, without moving. As the minutes passed, he sagged a little at the knees. The downpour rushed on. In the thick of it, great guns seemed to boom. Huge noises as of the tearing and rending of oak trees could be heard. There were also wild cries and terrible inhuman groanings. But Orlando stood there immovable till Paul's clock struck two, and then, crying aloud with an awful irony and all his teeth showing, "Jour de ma vie!" he dashed the lantern to the ground, mounted his horse and galloped he knew not where. Some blind instinct, for he was past reasoning, must have driven him to take the river bank in the direction of the sea. For when the dawn broke, which it did with unusual suddenness, the sky turning a pale yellow and the rain almost ceasing, he found himself on the banks of the Thames, off Wapping. Now a sight of the most extraordinary nature met his eyes. Where, for 3 months and more, there had been solid ice, of such thickness that it seemed permanent as stone, and a whole gay city had been stood on its pavement, was now a race of turbulent yellow waters. The river had gained its freedom in the night. It was as if a sulphur spring, to which view many philosophers inclined, had risen from the volcanic regions beneath, and burst the ice asunder with such vehemence that it swept the huge and massy fragments furiously apart. The mere look of the water was enough to turn one giddy. All was riot and confusion. The river was strewn with icebergs. Some of these were as broad as a bowling green and as high as a house, other no bigger than a man's hat, but most fantastically twisted. Now would come down a whole convoy of ice-blocks, sinking everything that stood in their way. Now, eddying and swirling like a tortured serpent, the river would seem to be hurtling itself between the fragments and tossing them from bank to bank, so that they could be heard smashing against the piers and pillars. But what was the most awful and inspiring of terror was the sight of the human creatures who had been trapped in the night, and now paced their twisting and precarious islands in the utmost agony of spirit. Whether they jumped into the flood or stayed on the ice, their doom was certain. Sometimes quite a cluster of these poor creatures would come down together, some on their knees, others suckling their babies. One old man seemed to be reading aloud from a holy book. At other times, and his fate was perhaps the most dreadful, a solitary wretch would stride his narrow tenement alone. As they swept out to sea, some could be heard crying vainly for help, making wild promises to amend their ways, confessing their sins and vowing altars and wealth, if God would hear their prayers. Others were so dazed with terror that they sat, immovable and silent, looking steadfastly before them. One crew of young watermen or postboys, to judge by their liveries, roared and shouted the lewdest tavern songs, as if in bravado, and were dashed against a tree and sunk with blasphemies on their lips. An old nobleman, for such his furred gown and chain proclaimed him, went down not far from where Orlando stood, calling vengeance upon the Irish rebels, who, he cried with his last breath, had plotted this devilry. Many perished clasping some silver pot or other treasure to their breasts, and at least a score of poor wretches were drowned by their own cupidity, hurling themselves from the bank into the flood, rather than let a gold goblet escape them, or see before their eyes the disappearance of some furred gown. For furniture, valuables, possessions of all sorts were carried away on the icebergs. Among other strange sights was to be seen a cat suckling its young, a table laid sumptuously for a supper of 20, a couple in bed, together with an extraordinary number of cooking utensils. Dazed and astounded, Orlando could do nothing for some time but watch the appalling race of waters as it hurled itself past him. At last, seeming to recollect himself, he clapped spurs to his horse and galloped hard along the river bank in the direction of the sea. Rounding a bend of the river, he came opposite that reach where, not 2 days ago, the ships of the ambassadors had seemed immovably frozen. Hastily he made count of them all, the French, the Spanish, the Austrian, the Turk, all still floated, though the French had broken loose from her moorings, and the Turkish vessel had taken a great rent in her side and was fast filling with water. But the Russian ship was nowhere to be seen. For one moment Orlando thought it must have foundered, but raising himself in his stirrups and shading his eyes, which had the sight of a hawk's, he could just make out the shape of a ship on the horizon. The black eagles were flying from the masthead. The ship of the Muscovite embassy was standing out to sea. Flinging himself from his horse, he made in his rage as if he would breast the flood. Standing knee-deep in water, he hurled at the faithless woman all the insults that have ever been the lot of her sex. Faithless, mutable, fickle, he called her. Devil, adulteress, deceiver. And the swirling waters took his words, and tossed at his feet a broken pot and a little straw. End of section 3.